Today on Always Record, we are going to be joined by two authors who have books coming out soon from Sync Book Press. That includes Fraterex, whose book will be The Secret War Inside Freemasonry, and Swami Anantanandagiri, whose book, The Gospel of Thomas, I've been helping to edit over the last year or so, and will be coming out literally within days of this program reaching the air.
If you want to know how to say the whole name, it's Swami Anantanandagiri. But you can just call me Swami or Swami A or whatever. You can call me Brandon if you want. I don't really care.
You can call me Al.
For the purposes, yeah.
Oh boy.
But for the purposes of the show, promoting the book and everything, probably Swami is the best way to go. Or whatever.
That's what I was gonna do. Could we call you Swami Giri? Another Swami Giri?
that'd get confusing, but that was a joke.
Okay. Yeah, I know. I'm just funning. But yes, I was going to call you Swami. I mean, you Swami A is because Ananta?
Yeah.
Yeah. What does that mean, by the way?
Ananta is, it means infinite.
Infinite.
And the Ananda suffix means bliss. Pretty much
bliss.
Almost every Swami you'll come across has that appended to their name. So I was Sri Ananta Yogi, and then I became a Swami, so the Ananda got appended to it. So infinite bliss, or the bliss of the infinite, something along those lines.
Well, you're yet another Swami in my life, man. So that's the way it goes. Sorry, that's how I'll refer to you.
Just before we brought you on, David was asking me, he said, is this the same Swami from Type 1 Radio? And I started to say no, but maybe you want to explain how you know the gentleman from Type 1 Radio.
Yeah, that would be Swami Shivanandagiri that you're referring to. And I have actually participated in some of the Type 1 discussions in the radio show early on, although I've kind of been preoccupied with other stuff lately and haven't really had a chance to pop in there much. But I met him through that whole crowd, and I happened to be a student of various schools of mysticism, and I was mostly interested in Taoism and yoga when I happened to meet him, and I had just kind of come across the idea of a sampradayam, or it's a tradition being connected to a lineage. A tradition through a guru. And I had just kind of, I had come to the point in my practice where I realized that that was just going to be necessary for me based on what I was trying to do and the teachings that I was into. I came across him and he's like, hey, I represent this lineage and come to you. You know, you're welcome to be a part of it. And so he's the person who introduced me to my guru in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, you clearly brought more learning to the table than what you received in your recent associations. It was clear to me from reading your material that you had already studied so much.
A little bit, but the subject, a lot of it, I did bring some knowledge to the table, and then I kind of went a little more deeply into that at the encouragement of my guru, and I had some instruction from Swami Shivananda also. He was my Swami teacher up until the point that I became a Swami. And right. So it's kind of, I mean, it's been, there hasn't really been a point where I've said, okay, it's, I can stop learning. It's just something that I do. So
I certainly understand that. Yeah.
What have
well, what I think I would probably say. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Please. Well, I was just going to clarify. I guess I wouldn't say if it was, you know, from what you've just said, to sort of clarify knowledge, maybe more understanding and insight. Clearly brought more understanding and insight than what was, you know, I mean, I've just gathered that from looking at your material that you definitely have been thinking about this stuff. And I'm very impressed, by the way. And what we're referring to here is this topic of conversation with our good friend Swami A here, who is the writer of the new commentary, Yogic Commentary on Gospel of Thomas, which is a very important work. And I'm really excited to be, you know, talking with you today about this, because it's material that I have held close for my own personal reasons, which I'd like to get into in our conversation, you know, and how the growth of understanding about this material and how important it is for people who have a dynamic relationship with Christianity, whether positive or negative, you know, and Christianity has had an effect on our culture, whether you're a Christian or not. You've been affected by Christianity, you know, we all have. And there's much to speak to with regards to this, I think. And the what I really appreciate with what you're doing here, Swami, and you know, I like the fact that we've clarified, because I'm friends with Swami Shivanandagiri from Type 1, and he was also at Free Your Mind Conference 2 in Philadelphia last April. And we became very good friends, and he's you know, a very insightful man as well, with much to speak to with relation to the teaching, the ways of liberation that your order that you belong to presents, you know, as tools for enlightenment for people who are, you know, who resonate with your truths that you present, you know, and so it's exciting, because I kind of came to these same conclusions myself as a younger man, looking at the same material that you go over in your work that we're discussing today.
I'm really curious if I haven't read your book on the Gospel of Thomas, and so you're approaching it from a philosophical Indian perspective. Is it, would you say it's more Vedantic, or is it like Samkhya, or what are you approaching it with, just out of curiosity?
My guru's guru is, well, he's not alive now, but I still talk to
him. Oh, shoot, you're breaking up a little bit. You guys hear that too?
Yeah, you cut out for me as well.
Okay. And me as well.
Okay, darn.
Okay, I'll start over.
Cool.
So the name of my guru's guru was, Swami Baba Muktananda, and he taught in terms of Advaita Vedanta and sure. And Kashmir Shaivism at the same time, which are at face value are actually kind of, they seem to be at odds with each other, because Advaita Vedanta is a school of negation. You know, you find the absolute by saying not this, not this, neti neti. Yeah. And you know, anything that you can point at is not the absolute, because anything that is that can be apprehended by the senses is inherently perishable. Kashmir Shaivism kind of approaches it from the other end and says that everything is the absolute, because what else could it have been made of? And that's one of the most fascinating things that I personally take away from Muktananda's teachings, is that he was able to reconcile those two points of view. And so that's kind of the approach that I've taken. I haven't really constricted myself to any one approach. But I have tried to point out what I see as allusions to Shaivism in the Gospel of Thomas, because I think that I'm the first person to have noticed those connections. Even though I don't think I'm not saying that it's necessarily an explicitly Shaiva work, but it. but it's clear to me that it was influenced by Shaivism and probably quite a few other quite a lot of other things. But I definitely do see a thread of that running through it also.
Awesome.
I think that's the unique aspect of what you're presenting here, is that angle, you know, that perspective. And I wanted to kind of begin set the tone of what we were talking about today by drawing right from one of the pages of the material here and reading this, because it sort of excited me when I came across it early on in the material. It's on page 51, where you said, "The seeker of the ultimate truth must eventually come to terms with the troubling fact that what is sought, being the subtlest of subtle, is beyond the reach of the five senses and cannot even begin to be comprehended by the mind." And this is, I think, the existential puzzle that each individual seeker on whatever individual path they're on, it sort of struggles, that sometimes wrestles, but other times comprehends and takes on board, is this understanding of what we're looking at, you know. And there's another little quote that you say that you've quote someone else where the quote is ancient, and it's, "He who knows not, and he who knows not knows." It's reminiscent of the Socratic method of not knowing, you know, and questioning through not knowing, which is in a form of that negation. And I understand the insight that can be gained through negation. That's a very common philosophical approach, Eastern and Western. You find that in the Western schools as well. And but what I think is exciting about this material as you've approached it, and I would never claim to, you know, usurp your perspective, though I have had similar insights or similar questions that you've taken the time to answer, that I would say I kind of wish I had written this book, really. But and I do regret not being able to be involved more in the, I was hoping, we had talked originally about doing a you know, an introduction or something like that with this, because I really am excited about the way you've gone this direction. And what I think it is a perspective outside of the normal continuity of looking at this material, because people don't normally grasp the idea that the Gospel of Thomas puts forth about Christianity, that we're talking about a bodhisattva-like way of liberation in which the individual is finding a liberation from samsara, you know, liberation from the continuing cycle of reincarnation into material existence, you know, and the weighing down of insight that brings under this, you know. I'm not a swami here. I'm just talking as a person who's looked at it, you know, philosophically as well, though, for a long time. Because, and I, maybe I could take a moment, if I could just be long-winded as I am, and talk about my own history with the Gospel of Thomas. For me, I came out of a very strong Christian traditions that were around my family, my own personal household. My mother was much more open to the gospel, or the goddess within the gospel, and the sacred feminine, and the ideas that became very new agey in the 80s and 90s in the women's studies groups. And my mother was very much involved in that. So I kind of got that secondhand exposure. And for me, it was sort of hokey, but at some point along the way, I began to look more at it. And it's because of my early experience with Christianity. Christianity was something I did embrace as a young man, and did try to find the mystical meaning of, and try to apply it, you know, as a real, you know, I did take on the ideas that were put forth, this idea of original sin, this idea of a need of correction, of salvation through, you know, it inevitably becomes blood sacrifice, really, through ideology, if not, you know, not in reality, but in the ideological approach of Christianity, that's what's being offered in the Pauline gospel, is a blood sacrifice as atonement for an original sin. That's a belief you have to take on board. you know, it's not inherent, as I would say, but for me, that's what happened, is that I did take on that belief for a long time as a young man, and then experienced the full consequences of that a person goes through existentially, and realized that there was an inherent flaw, and then need to solve the problem. Well, what is the truth? And realizing that there's many more paths up the mountaintop and many more ways to understand reality, the greater experience, supreme existence. And along the way, I came across the Gospel of Thomas, which we know was connected with the Nag Hammadi Library originally.
We lost Ananta, but it looks like he might be coming back. There. You back?
Are you back with us?
Hey, guys, I'm back.
Hey.
Sorry.
So I'm sure undoubtedly you missed part of Frederick's explanation there of his introduction to this material. I just, if you don't mind, I want to kind of backtrack. You made a comment, this was the beginning of your statement there, Frater, where you said, you mentioned the phrase bodhisattva and this idea of releasing from samsara, the cycle of death and birth. This is a question I have for you regarding your lineage, Swami. There is, I understand, in a lot of these traditions, there's a debate, if you will, as to whether or not being a bodhisattva in the more literal sense is a good thing. There are some traditions that actually take the idea of compassion, of returning to try and liberate all of humanity, as actually one of the final stumbling blocks, that to have compassion is something you have to actually get over so you yourself can be released from this. What do your traditions say about this idea?
Well, as you all probably know, Buddhism was kind of an offshoot of Hinduism at a certain point in history. So there's a lot of common ground. They're both dharmic in nature. A lot of the fundamental practices are the same, but they definitely differ on that point. I haven't met any Hindus who really grab on to the whole bodhisattva concept of a compassionate, enlightened being attaining liberation but voluntarily choosing to come back. Everybody that I've heard speak on the matter who is enlightened says, I'm getting the hell out of here as soon as this body craps out on me. I've had enough of this fucking place. But it's a philosophy. I mean, to me personally, it seems like a philosophical difference and one that's really a really personal matter. So
It's funny because I take the idea of Jesus, the story at least of Jesus dying and coming back and then going back into the all again, or ascending into heaven, whatever phraseology we want to use, I take it as him dying and coming back to say, look, you can do this, follow me, we can go there, is, in a sense, at least symbolically, speaking to that concept.
And for clarity's sake, the whole reference I made was really an offhand reference to stuff that, like, for example, what Holger Kirsten refers to in the Jesus Lives in India and the Jesus Conspiracy. He makes reference to this. I do this often. I'm overgeneralizing. I'm making sort of a generalization with the centuries-old Enlightenment traditions that you referred to, the idea that there were these quote-unquote bodhisattva schools that had kind of risen up in Asia Minor and around the region where he postulates the possibility that Jesus, in his lost years, attended one of these schools and learned, you know, Swami-like approach to, you know, the ways of liberation. And you know, my exposure to that was in the 90s when I first met my wife, Mater X. She had that book sitting on her bookshelf, Jesus Lived in India, and I had just sort of woken up to the ideas of the non-canonical texts, you know, the books outside the Bible canon that were gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas. And then here comes this Holger Kirsten cat with all this ideas of Jesus migrating to India and dying in Kashmir, and the whole thing of Prophet Isa and what the meaning of this was, and we, you know, we can get into that. And you actually cover some of that material, and he also speaks of the Russian researcher there who you talk about at the end of your book that we're talking about today. It's a school or a monastery, right, in Kashmir, where the scrolls were kept that referred to the Issa character in their histories?
Yeah, those were first discovered by Nicholas Notovich.
There it is, Russian explorer, right?
Yeah, and the monastery is the Hemist Buddhist monastery in Tibet in the Himalayas. Yeah. And there's some contention over that point. A lot of people have tried to say that it doesn't exist, which I would expect to be the case, whether it did exist or not. But it's been corroborated by some people that I personally think are pretty trustworthy.
You know, that brings up a good point that maybe we should kind of address right now. It's something you also speak of, and I try to speak to people about when we're talking about this kind of material, is the idea of historical accuracy or literal translation or and whether it affects the validity or the authenticity of teachings that may be therein, you know, contained, such as parables, fables, myths, legends. And for me, I guess I take a more libertine approach than others as far as my thinking that, you know, it doesn't matter if the story is true to convey an important message in teaching. It's not as important to me unless we're trying to learn specific ideas about a thing that's, you know, it's being presented as, you know, scientific data that we're supposed to believe is true or historical information. If we're looking at something allegorically or symbolically, it doesn't need to be necessarily true. And I'm thinking of a conversation I had recently with a Christian friend of mine who I am trying to get to read the Dead Sea Scrolls and read the Nag Hammadi and look at these other books to get a greater understanding of his own faith. And he mentioned how the validity of the subject matter concerned him and other esoteric schools. The validity, you know, is are these claims based on things that people are making up, or are they true, accurate historical facts? And I said, so let me ask you this then. You're telling me that if the material that's being presented as historical fact is not true, then it loses authenticity? And I sort of left that question hanging in the air. He didn't get it, but I was pointing to his own faith, you know, in the Pauline doctrine of Christianity as opposed to a more reminiscent of what the teachings of Jesus that are found in the Gospels, and especially the Gospel of Thomas, the ways of liberation.
So let me ask you this then. You think that the story of the tortoise and the hare would still be valid if a tortoise didn't really agree to race a rabbit?
I'll leave that one hanging in the air for the listeners at the time.
I mean, in terms of historical validity, I can only speak to that so much, being so far removed from it. And I don't think you're asking me to really, but the point that I would like to add is just that it's an experiential thing, you know. Different people subscribe to different beliefs, and that's, you know, that's natural, and we shouldn't really if everybody were the same, you know, what would be the point of us all being here? But in terms of looking at the tradition that we're talking about, in the context that we're talking about it, the apocryphal texts and things like that, that are obviously a tradition of enlightenment, of gnosis. These are things where their merit is, it doesn't have anything to do with their historical value, unless you're a scholar of religion. If you're their real value to at least to me, and I think their highest value, I think, is their ability for people to have the experience that they describe. And if you apply these methods to your life, their formulas to have that experience. And if you apply them to your life, you'll have the experience, and they will enrich your life.
So bringing it back to the specific topic, this Gospel of Thomas, I want to kind of set the stage here when we're thinking in terms and approaching this book, because what we're talking about is a world, as we all know, where the abuse and intolerance, persecution and suppression that the church has perpetrated on humanity was in fact, you know, committed by this organization that claimed to follow the teachings of Jesus, the Prince of Peace, the divine holy redeemer, whose blood sacrifice was for the forgiveness of all humanity. And the point is that the church knew that the quote unquote Gnostics, which I don't believe they referred to themselves as this, but this is what we do. We look back and sort of reverse engineer this and think the Gnostics, quote unquote, these groups, these sectarians who were all around in the first and second century AD, they had direct knowledge that absolutely, you know, the claims that the church had based their entire system of dogma and control around was, you know, the self-proclaimed guardians of divinity revealed this idea that that Jesus was the divine savior of all. You know, Christ died for our sins, and what that all meant was it was based on the accounts of a man who the actual original disciples viewed and called the spouter of lies. They called him someone who, you know, and this is all based on material that we find with Professor Robert Eisenman, one of the original scroll scholars who's put out a bunch of work. One of them is this huge book that I have and have almost finished. It's like 900 and something pages long, the James, the Brother of Jesus, which is completely drawing upon the scroll material that's found in the Dead Sea and Qumran area of the River Jordan. And also, I think he touches some upon or references to the Nag Hammadi works from Robinson, which you also draw a lot upon. And I think the point that needs to be made here is that the teachings that are being presented in the Gospel of Thomas is a whole different species of spiritual approach, of insight into spiritual development. And I think we can speak to that a bit as we move through this, because that's what makes this relevant. You know, you mentioned in the beginning before I started speaking here, you talked about how, you know, these are tools. These are ways of approach that people can take on board and they can get results from. And that's, I think, the danger that this material presented at the time, because it provided a way for people to not need a priesthood, to not need an ecclesiastical authority to guide and govern them, to tell them what to do and to tell them what to believe, that they might be led as a collective through whatever policies the state deemed worthy of them.
I'm always amazed at the New Testament selections for the canon in the first place. Like a lot of those the Apocrypha books have things of so much value, like when Jesus is looking on all the people in hell and it's asked of him, you know, what's going to happen to these people or these souls. And he's like, that basically communicates that not a single one will be lost, and that, like, implying that this is a place of refinement, which was always the Old Testament representation of hell. There's no eternal hell. It's a straightening. So, like if you were to, you know, straighten out a sword, you know, like in the heat. So that if something's not in alignment, it's a place to work things out. And then that's just cause and effect in that way. And rather than a punishment, it's just the nature of things. Which is the way that it's presented, and that should be in the New Testament. And I always find that amazing. That seems kind of important.
Well, you know, Swami, what really excited me about the book was that you cover material like this, and as well, you cover the material regarding reincarnation versus resurrection, which is really exciting because I've often wondered this myself. and the idea that the you really break down the Essene way of thought and the quotes from Josephus and just the understanding of what was being present, you know, what's been kind of I would venture to say glossed over or reworded for the public consumption of the teachings that were presented by the way, the followers of the man we know of as Jesus. If he existed, it doesn't really matter to me. What matters is that there was a tradition that existed in this time period that basically a teaching of with followers that was most probably a splinter sect of the Essenes or the Nazarenes, and was definitely part of the movement we could call the Ebwanim, or the people of the poor in spirit. And these teachings of these sectarians were available to undermine, you know, the priestly authority and threaten the people. You know, basically they were threatening revolutionary overthrow of the hated Roman occupiers, and also the people who were empowered by them, which were the Pharisees and Sadducees. So there was a huge power vacuum that was being created. And because the Pharisees and Sadducees, as everyone knows, owed their existence and their success to their positions of power to the Romans. And therefore, if they went, you know, that would be bad news for them. And the bottom line is these followers of this way, their leader, the messianic leader that was probably killed, you know, or mortally or near mortally wounded, he never claimed exclusive divinity. He never promised a means of salvation through crucifixion. It was the later work of Paul, you know, this man that was considered by many to be under the influence of evil spirits. His road to Damascus vision was thought of by these groups in the works of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the other materials. They thought of him as someone who that was like a demonic experience for him on the road to Damascus. As far as they were concerned, he was learning spiritual teachings from demons. And you know, that's, I think, could be considered allegorical from a socio-political sense, because I would suspect that the man who set up the religion that we could call Pauline Christianity was probably an agent provocateur who was, you know, his intent was to infiltrate this very threatening movement and undermine it from within by, you know, undermining the leadership. I mean, the historical accounts claim that Paul actually attacked James, the brother of Jesus, who was the true heir, mentioned in Gospel of Thomas, which is another important reason why we look at this material, because it's the Gospel of Thomas, which mentions that when the disciples come to Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas and they say, who do we go to when you're gone? You keep talking about how you're going to be leaving. Who do we go to when you're gone? And he says, you'll go to James in Jerusalem. And you quote this, Swami, that it's for him that earth, the heaven and earth came into existence. That is so profound a way of liberation, enlightenment statement, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a lot of points and some stuff that I was not aware of. Like, I had never heard of Paul attacking James. I kind of get a kick out of that. I don't know, you covered so much ground. I don't know where to start. But,
sorry.
But your most recent point about Jesus telling the disciples, they explicitly ask, you know, when you're not around, where do we turn? And he says, go to James. That's an example of guru parampara, guru, the tradition of the guru disciple relationship. The guru, you know, the guru has a personal relationship with God. He's, you know, he is, if assuming you have a qualified guru, and that's the goal of the tradition, then the guru is somebody who never perceives any difference between anything at all and God, because everything is just a manifestation of the absolute. Everything's divine in that sense. And so the guru is always in communion with God, and he has the power of, he has the divine power of grace. He bestows that on his disciples. He awakens that that perspective inside of them and fosters it until it's permanent in them also. And then eventually the original guru form goes into entropy, because that's what bodies do. But his disciples carry on the tradition. That's exactly what he was talking about. And the name Paul is, like you pointed out, conspicuously absent from that discussion.
And of course, Peter. Oh, sorry.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
You know, Frederick's talked about this idea of a path of liberation absent of a priesthood. How do you distinguish between the guru hierarchy and the priesthood hierarchy?
I guess it depends on the tradition. I'm not really... I'm not really as knowledgeable about that maybe as I should be.
Idea of a guru is a teacher. That's what the literal definition of the term guru is, teacher. You know, so there is that distinction. When the priesthood I refer to would be a hierarchical system with, you know, extreme measures of control that are being placed over populations based on state government policies. You know, this is what the priesthoods that were in place around the temple system in Jerusalem of the first century, where right before the fall of Jerusalem, right before Rome destroyed the temple and just basically destroyed everything according to history.
Absolutely. It was more of a, you know, a sort of just a prodding question to open up a...
You're such a troublemaker, Alan. You always got a rabble-rouse, don't you?
David, maybe I'd actually like to just bring this one second over to you. You know, obviously the term rabbi also means teacher, right?
Yeah.
And you and I have discussed this a number of times. Swami mentioned this idea of neti neti, not this, not this. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this in the Jewish tradition, the idea that anything that you can imagine as the Ein Sof, the supreme, the absolute, anything that you can imagine being certainly not it.
Right, so you say put no gods before me, it literally, what does that entail? So like even when Adam and Eve put on skin, when they leave their garden, that is something between them and their true selves. So, you know, there's a suggestion of, you know, our essential etheric being that we have like a substitute representation of, and that essentially is a god before God, because God is ourself. So, and then that's the message of, ultimately, the message of Jesus, you know, if you really want to take things literally, you know, because he's... You know, I and the Father are one, and I'm one with you. That's what the sharing of the bread is supposed to mean.
And Yeshua, Jesus means I am salvation. I am again the whole, you know, the God, the proclamation of Yahweh, right? But what I like what you're saying though is kind of triggers and fires the Zen Buddhist ideas that float around in my mind, the non-dualistic approach of the no God before thee. You know, it's that mindset of non-duality that in what I have drawn is the conclusion that when Jesus makes these statements about when what is within you is like what is without you, it's this reference to this quote unquote eternal state that he refers to, for me is like the state beyond time and space, where, you know, it's like the kingdom of heaven within you. It's that liberated state, that enlightened state. And I kind of got that from reading your material, Swami. You sort of resonated with that as well.
Can you clarify that?
I thought at some point you referenced the idea that, you know, the kingdom of, or you called it the eternal kingdom or the heavenly kingdom. And I thought you were making reference to the enlightened state in a couple of places when you were going over the different chapters of the Gospel of Thomas. Maybe I just totally read into that, you know. But that's kind of
that's exactly how I interpret any reference to the kingdom as entirely just the enlightened state of perceiving reality, because it's not any particular place. It's not somewhere that you can go, which Jesus says explicitly. It's just a euphemism. It's a, it's just an idiom that's peculiar to that particular tradition. And it's not like that's even the only place that it shows up. It shows up in other traditions. It just seems like in the Gospel of Thomas, that's just like their go-to figure of speech for that concept.
Well, that's a good point. He makes reference in other Gospels, in the canonical works, in the Bible, he makes references too of the kingdom of heaven, and I already had kind of come to that conclusion myself about it, as that eternal state being the enlightened state, and that's really an exciting thing. I also wanted to—I forgot to mention at the beginning of our talk that there's one part of the gospel that you didn't mention that I thought was sort of relevant to our talk, because I want to, for anybody who's very Christian fundamentally, you know, fundamentalist Christian view that might listen to this podcast here, you know, I'm not trying to disrespect or degrade the true message that I believe that the quote unquote savior or the master or whatever, however you want to refer to the figure who stands as a central spokesperson of the teachings that are inherent to true Christianity. I just don't think that the state version, the so-called Catholic, universal, church, Christian tradition mainstream that we are presented in America, I don't think it is the same teaching. And so that's my distinction. I'm not trying to disrespect Jesus or his followers. And I would quote from the gospel itself where there's a part where I think it's Mark 9, I wrote it down somewhere, like chapter 38 or something, I believe, where Mark 9, verse 38, where he says, the disciples come run over the hill and they say to Jesus, there's a guy over on the other side of the hill and he's casting out demons in your name and he's not with us. He's not part of our group and he's casting out demons in your name. And he turned to them and said, is he doing bad stuff? And they're like, no, but he's not with us. And he's out there doing it. And he's like, well, then leave him alone. I mean, and the quote is, he says, if he's not against us, then he's with us. If he's doing good in our name, leave him alone. You know, and so I put that out there kind of philosophically speaking to point out that Jesus was very tolerant, even right there in the gospel, you know, about other people's views and about how what people might derive from his teaching and how they may apply it, and it might be completely different than his own teaching is being applied, right?
Yeah, can I interject my own opinion?
Yes, of course.
What you said about your opinion that the state sanctioned version of the religion is just not the I kind of wanted to go over this anyway because you already touched on it, and I basically agree with you, if you go back to the source, you have to admit there's just not any way around admitting that there was this Eastern style tradition of enlightenment or gnosis going on, and that it was acceptable. It was there and it was acceptable. You can't deny it. So there were at least two forms of Christianity, and it's normal for there. I hesitate to say that it was the only form of Christianity, though, because even in Hinduism, you have the same thing. You have people striving for enlightenment, and then you have people that are satisfied with another version of the same thing. But they realize that it's the same thing. They just have a different approach to it. They're approaching it from a dualistic point of view. They see themselves as distinct from other things. And they don't necessarily see the need. They might not necessarily see the need to merge into everything, like you, to become one with everything, to actually experience the reality of Advaita or non-dualism. They just, they probably hear about it on a regular basis, but they just have. But it's normal for people to not really appreciate the gravity of those kinds of statements, and so the same thing can express in a dualistic way too. So I'm inclined to believe that there were, you know, there were people approaching it from a dualistic perspective, and people approaching it from the perspective of, I want to become perfect in this body. I want to become a Jivan Mukta. And there's some reference to that in the Bible, but then it comes back around to what you're saying, Frater, about the state sanctioned religion. It obviously, at a certain point in history, it became a psyop. I mean, there's not really any arguing that point either. It's what it became, and at that point it became taboo and potentially life threatening to be on the wrong side of that debate.
Yeah,
that attitude is carried over into the Christianity of today a lot, and I think that's what the problem is. And that's kind of what I wanted to do with this book, is just kind of point out, you know, hey, if you want to approach it from a dualistic point of view, if that's your take on it, that's great. You know, there's something for you there. Krishna said in the Bhagavad Gita, a little bit of this yoga, even a little bit of this yoga, never goes to waste.
I feel like I need to mention something here. I'm being called to communicate that, you know, with the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, those are actually considered a dualistic system, even though in the zenith of it, or whatever you want to call it, if you take the practice to the full extreme, it's non-dual. So the highest states are non-dual states, yet the system itself is one of duality. And I've seen that paralleled in Christianity a lot, where there's an ultimate non-dualism that's being presented, but everything leading up to it is dualistic, for lack of another way to communicate it. Does that make any sense? Or
absolutely. I mean, that's actually what I was going to just bring up here, because if we take the concept that everything is a manifestation of God in that respect, then even the side, like, I'm not disagreeing at all that modern Christianity is a form of brainwashing and political control. I don't think any of us on this call would disagree with that statement. Yet how do we sort of juxtapose that with the idea that everything is a manifestation of the Godhead? Well, the only way that really seems to make at least a bit of rational sense is that this in itself is almost how you were describing hell earlier, David. It's like this is almost the necessary process through which we have to go through to fully understand that we need to rise above it.
The great straightening.
Yeah.
No, I think it's funny. I think it's hilarious how we can show clearly several different perspectives of this approach to this. And that's the point I was making earlier about how my own quest to understand my own existential puzzle, you know, was the realization that there are so many paths up the mountaintop. There are so many ways that individuals approach reality that works for them. I mean, you can't say that one way is the way it is, or the one way is the explanation, or one way is the solution, or whatever. I mean, it's very funny. But, you know, for me, the point of making it the backdrop of the political psyop of Christianity in the mainstream directly connects with this Gospel of Thomas again, with the very important Christian document that was circulated, you know, widely throughout all of the Orient, quote unquote, of the, you know, first three centuries of Christian history, and then eventually completely suppressed and disappears until some 1500 or so years later, it turns up again, rediscovered in Nag Hammadi. And the most significant aspect that we already discussed is not the specific teaching of the Savior in the dialogue therein, but the claim that James was the replacement of Jesus for the leader of the disciples. James, not Paul, not Peter, who is the claim of the Vatican. You know, the vicar of Christ is the, all the popes are connected to Peter, and the donation of Constantine some 400 years later in 600, all of a sudden they show up with this document that they claim was written by the Emperor Constantine in this new myth that says that Constantine received leprosy, he got leprosy, and Pope Sylvester heals him, and then he's so grateful that before he dies, he signs over all the temporal powers of Holy Rome to the vicars of Christ through the Pope's lineage. And that's where the whole, you know, the Catholic Church is born in this moment, the donation of Constantine, which, you know, it's not really talked about. But the point is the Gospel of Thomas clearly undermines that claim with the idea that James. And then if you look in the New Testament itself, in the book of Acts, you have Paul going to Jerusalem. He goes to the pillars. That's what he calls them. And it's James and Judah and Peter, or James, John, and Peter is who he goes to. And James is the leader of that little triumvirate in Jerusalem. It's James the Just is what he was called, but he was also called James the Lesser for some reason. And this is the school tradition, I think, that you allude to, Swami, this idea of the transmission of the lineage or the teaching when that clearly is being... That's the dialogue, really, clearly, is, hey, this is my successor or my, you know, my teacher, my guru teacher for you as your Swami. You know, this is him right here, and he will continue. But also, Thomas, the word Thomas, we haven't covered this yet, Didymus in Greek, Thomas means twin, the twin. So it's interesting that he's referred to the twin as he travels through these traditions in the Orient. After the crucifixion, when the churches that are being founded that become the seven jewel churches that are brought up in the book of Revelation, you know, there's a very important group of churches that supposedly Thomas founded in his ecclesiastical journey, in his evangelical travels, you know, after the crucifixion. But we know him in mainstream America, he's the Doubting Thomas. He's downsized, he's relegated, his commitment to the whole thing is called into question because he doubts, you know, and so even his claim authority of knowing Jesus is all in question. Why would they do that? Why do they call Thomas into such question, you know, as an authority, if not to divert us from the teaching therein?
Or there is, you know, maybe perhaps embedded in that is actually a more esoteric concept. The fact is that Thomas doubted and actually had to physically experience. The idea is that Thomas says, well, I don't know, and actually sticks his finger into the wounds of Jesus and says, okay, now I know. Well, this is
right,
this is the Gnostic concept. I don't know, is there a God? Let me experience it. Holy shit, there really is.
Yeah, materialism, totally, I love it. That's awesome, I didn't even think of that. That's really cool.
So, I don't agree with a lot of the things that Joseph Atwill extrapolates, but there's some key components that are pretty undeniable. I don't know how familiar you guys are with his work or his ideas, but I feel, you know, like it's worth mentioning here, is that I can't quite reconcile why it is that all the first recorded Christians of the gospel text are all of the Flavian court. Why it is that if Christians are being killed for Christianity, you know, why, like, their texts, like you have the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi, you have these things are hidden away. You know, they went to great lengths to keep them from being destroyed. While the Romans destroyed, you know, everything, every account of history other than their own. So all you have now, like, I was in Seattle recently, and my girlfriend's mother was reading The Killing of Jesus by Bill O'Reilly. And as soon as I see that, I'm like, okay, it's Bill O'Reilly's account of Christianity. I immediately flipped to the back to see what, and I said it before I looked. I was like, what has he got other than Josephus Flavius and the gospel? And he says, in listed sources, it says Josephus Flavius, the Gospel, and other sources. And I'm like, what other sources? Because what do you have? You know, and there's nothing for him. And so it's all just his own ideas or whatever. But I it's amazing to me. Like, I don't see how it couldn't have been written in Greek. If you go to take any course on the New Testament, you know, from Christians, especially fundamentalist Christians, they will say that the text you're looking at is either, you know, two or three copies removed from the original. Meanwhile, people who have applied, you know, gematria to the text and seen the way that it's arranged, there's very little question that you're looking at the original text or something very close to it, and that it was written in Greek. So how is this the people's representation of their religion in lower class Judea if it's written in Greek? You'd think it would be written in Aramaic, right? Because that's their language. So there's very little convincing arguments if you want to apply Occam's razor to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as being absolutely authentic as the people's religion. Meanwhile, I myself would be far more inclined to consider a work that's hanging off of a rope in a cave, you know, as something to consider more if you're looking at the people's religion, you know. And so I have my own, you know, kind of reactions to statements throughout the gospel. One that immediately comes to mind is, you know, asking about taxes. Give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, you know, like give unto God what is God's and give unto me what is mine. Pay your taxes. Like, you know, this is something that you're putting into motion that we actually could have had a stand on. That, like, brings to mind the Templars and, you know, and just, it just feels crazy to me to say that that's a revolutionary thing. Like, I'm down with yielding to overcome. Like, I can understand that. I can understand how Gandhi and Martin Luther King related to Christianity. But if you want to follow through, you know, they were about nonviolent resistance, and they meant resistance. And there's a lot of things in the gospel that feel kind of manipulative in that way to me. When you look at how extreme the Sicarii were, and that they wanted to end in occupation.
Brainwashed in our childhood, brainwashed by the school, brainwashed by our teachers, and brainwashed by all the rules, brainwashed by our leaders, by our kings and queens, brainwashed in the open and brainwashed behind the scenes.
God, God, God,
our voice cries in the wilderness.
God, God, God,
it was on the longest night.
God, God, God,
an eternity of darkness.
God, God, God,
someone turned out the spiritual light. Brainwashed by the Nikkei, I'm brainwashed by Dow Jones, brainwashed by the FTSE, NASDAQ and secure loans, brainwashed us from Brussels, brainwashing us in Bonn, brainwashing us in Washington, Westminster in London.
God, God, God,
you are the wisdom that we seek.
God, God, God,
the lover that we miss.
God, God, God,
your nature is eternity. Knowledge,
page 130.
They brainwashed my great uncle, brainwashed cousin Bob. They even got my grandma when she was working for the mob. Brainwash you while you're sleeping, while in your traffic jam. Brainwash you while you're weeping, while still a baby in your prime. Brainwashed by the military, brainwashed under duress. Brainwashed by the media, you're brainwashed by the press. Brainwashed by computer, brainwashed by mobile phones. Brainwashed by the satellite, brainwashed to the bone.
God, God, God,
won't you lead us through this mess?
God, God, God,
from the places of concrete. Things worse than ignorance.
God, God, God,
I just won't accept defeat.
God, God, God,
must be something I forgot.
God, God, God,
down on Bullshit Avenue.
God, God, God,
we can only stop the rot.
God, God, God,
wish that you'd brainwash us too. Parvati Pataye Hara Hara Mahadev. Nama Parvati Pataye Hara Hara. Nama Parvati Pataye Hara Hara. Shiva Shiva Shankar Mahadeva. Hara 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 Mahadeva. Shiva Shiva Shankar Mahadeva. Shiva Shiva Shankar Mahadeva. Nama Parvati Pataye Hara Hara. Nama Parvati Pataye Hara Hara. Shiva Shiva Shankar Mahadeva. Shiva Shiva Shankar Mahadeva.